How constant surveillance puts protesters at risk. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. As Black Lives Matter protests continue around the country, police are using facial recognition and all kinds of other technology to arrest protesters and organizers. And while in some cases the people arrested did commit crimes, after-the-fact arrests can have a chilling effect on free speech and lead to cases of mistaken identity. They also show us just how much surveillance is part of our lives. Simone Brown is a professor at UT Austin. She's also author of the book Dark Matters on the Surveillance of Blackness. She told me about how police identified and arrested a protester in Philadelphia.
There was a tattoo on her arm, and she was wearing a T-shirt that was, you know, quite unique. It said, keep the immigrants, deport the racists. And so the police used the images of her. They went to find out, you know, where did she get this shirt made? And they found her comment that she made on Etsy. They looked at her Instagram. They looked at her LinkedIn profiles, and they were able to match her, this image, to identify her. And she was eventually charged. So all this is to say that there's still just the kind of trails of data, actually, that we leave about ourselves that is being used to form a case.
To what extent, to your knowledge, is some of this technology being used to find and arrest protesters and even protest organizers?
Well, I think the chilling effect that organizers, but also the ACLU, became quite aware and worked to challenge was around 2015, 2016 or so. This company, Geofedia, which is really a company that's a kind of social media analysis company that was working, hand in hand with various policing agencies to monitor keywords, Black Lives Matter, protests, jihad. All of these things were then, you know, tagged and flagged to then, in some cases, visit. You know, you'd have a policing agency visit a potential protester. And of course, if you go onto Geofedia's website now, there's like nothing really, just contact information. But we know if something is out there, if Geofedia is gone, another company will pop up and, you know, fill in that gap.
When you layer on all of this technology that you've described, it sounds like it could be relatively accurate. And I could see police departments falling into the idea that, you know, that although there have been concerns that facial recognition isn't always accurate, once you add in social media, like, this should work great. What is the pushback to that?
Mm-hmm. And so the idea of something, you know, working great, if just one person is wrongly identified, say, for example, with facial recognition technology, then it's not working at all. These technologies rely on this idea that they are perfect, correct, but they really aren't. And so people are asking for a pause because these technologies are not outside of the system in which we live in, where, you know, Black people are criminalized.
Right. How do you feel like this? The long-term implications of this surveillance might play out. Will people be less willing to take the risk of exercising their right to protest?
I don't think so. And I think in terms that people, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and yet people are still, you know, risking a lot to go out and protest and demand something better. I think one case, and I'll give you an example that I think is important, is in terms of DNA collection. And so a lot of people, you know, want to, their armchair genealogist, or also want to find family or some type of connection. And they use a company like, say, 23andMe or Ancestry.com or GEDmatch. And that same company, GEDmatch, was then recently purchased, I think just last year, by a company that has close ties to, you know, a policing agency. And this company is not just about finding long lost relatives, but they say they're primarily for forensic, you know, analysis. So it's the question of, like, whether it's Etsy or whether it's Ancestry.com. It's like, we have to really think about what happens to that data.
Well, it's interesting. It feels like it's a thing that privacy researchers have warned about for a long time, that there is essentially a big web of surveillance and we're leaving tracks all the time, and that it isn't always obvious what the harm might be until something like this happens.
Exactly. But, you know, they're also tech. One of the places that I look to see, you know, what's the future, perhaps, or the future that's already here, is looking at airport security. And there have been a lot of push in terms of AI-enabled technologies to assess risk, to assess threat. And one of the things that, you know, a few companies are starting to develop now is emotion recognition. And so that might be that a traveler might present themselves at an airport, speak to an avatar. In one company, avatar actually stands for automated virtual agent for truth assessment. And this avatar will then ask them a series of questions, and then measurements are then taken, by the changes in their voice, by, you know, heat or sweat or any type of what might be termed a micro expression of guilt, like that your heart rate increasing, those types of things. And then, you know, assign a certain threat category to see if that person might be a threat to airport security. And so I don't necessarily know if these types of technologies are being used to monitor protest activists and other moments of rebellion, but it is something, you know, to look out for.
That pause was, yeah, that's terrifying. Is there ear recognition? Is that a thing?
Yes. And so there's recognition of everything. And it's almost like, you know, throwing something to the wall and seeing, you know, what hits. But the ear has been, it's a relatively stable part of the body. And that has been, you know, known since Alphonse Bertillon, which is said to be the father of forensic sciences, was using that in the 1800s as a stable way of recognizing or identifying the human body to catalog them. And so there are researchers that are working on, you know, every part and piece of the body that you could think imaginable as a way to try and, you know, shore up this idea, which is just an idea, that the human body is stable, that the human can be categorized and identified. And we know that's, you know, bodies don't work that way, but, you know, the science does.
Your book is called Dark Matters on the Surveillance of Blackness. We've been talking about this in the context of protest. Why is this surveillance of particular concern to Black Americans?
It's a particular concern, but because it has been the state, you know, I say surveillance is the fact of anti-Blackness, not only in the U.S., but globally. And so it's been a concern here in the U.S. For centuries. We're thinking about slave patrols, plantation control, all of these technologies that were put in place to deem Black people as outside of the right to have rights. But it's also why I think it's important to study the history of surveillance within transatlantic slavery, within plantation slavery, because it also offers us moments of resistance and moments of rebellion and escape to something different, something that looks like freedom.
Simone Brown is a professor at UT Austin and author of the book Dark Matters. And now for some related links. Portland, the site of months of protest, last week passed the strictest law against facial recognition tech in the country. The ban says city agencies cannot use the technology in public places, and neither can private companies or governments. A story about this in Popular Mechanics notes that the ban means police can't use any form of facial recognition software on surveillance video they collect, and that the ban would also apply at, say, the Portland airport, where Delta is using facial recognition technology to check passengers in for flights. It would also apply to a chain of convenience stores in Portland that apparently was using video surveillance and facial recognition to remotely determine whether someone could enter a store. They were remotely locking and unlocking doors based on people's faces. The Portland ban would not apply to personal use, stories were quick to point out, so you could still use your face to unlock your iPhone, assuming you still feel comfortable with that, I guess. Now on to another topic. We are working on a special show at Marketplace Tech about adapting to and surviving climate change and extreme weather. And we want to hear from you. What, if anything, have you done to adapt to climate change in your life? Did you install air conditioning? Maybe get backup power for your house? Go gray water? Did you get solar, put in new windows, or buy an air purifier? Did you move? Or do you feel stuck because you don't have the money to do any of those things? Please email us, mptech@marketplace.org. Send us voice memos if you like, or just tell us your stories. And thank you in advance. And if you're in the smoke stream, a fire zone, or a hurricane path, or hopefully none of those, I hope you have a safe and healthy weekend. Stephanie Hughes produces Marketplace Tech. Jesus Alvarado is our assistant producer. Michael Lipkin is our senior editor. Robin Edgar and Becca Weinman engineer the show. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.